All right, so let's catch everyone up to make sure we're on the same page. So this is a sort of a two-parter that could be a 5 to 10-parter. We're just going to do two in light of the Pesach week coming up. And it's sort of a very brief attempt to tackle a very overarching, somewhat philosophical question. But I think it's a philosophical question that exposes some really fascinating sort of fundamental theological principles about Judaism and how we view ourselves. And so even if it isn't necessarily completely practical in our everyday lives, I think it really frames how we think about ourselves and in particular relationship with property. So what we framed last time, just in brief, is that there are two larger questions that are raised in the world of philosophy and in legal circles as well with regard to the notion of property. First question is, philosophically, what is the basis for the very notion of property ownership? We take it for granted. It's part of our everyday lives. We purchase homes. We purchase all sorts of trinkets and objects. In fact, in our world, we tend to compile lots and lots and lots of even unwanted objects that we happen to own but just haven't gotten around to getting rid of until at least this time of year when we finally have the opportunity to get rid of them, and then we get overwhelmed and you know how all that goes. But be that as it may, the very notion of property ownership from a philosophical question, even though functionally we take it for granted, it's not actually an obvious matter. What does it mean, or how is it that I have a right to acquire this cup of Diet Sprite? On what basis is it now mine? Right? What gives me the right to own something? What is that? Where does that actually come from? And in fact, there were some at least radical thinkers who questioned the very notion of property ownership and property rights. Jean-Pierre Proudhon, who is a fairly radical French thinker, but he claims that property is impossible. A more mainstream and certainly very well-known thinker, Thomas Aquinas, the great medievalist, the great medieval Christian thinker, philosopher, theologian, who says that at first glance, he claims that it would seem unlawful for a man to possess a thing as his own, and then he has to work in order to justify the notion of property. So first of all, where does this notion really come from? And then secondly, we ask the question, what is the nature of property ownership? And we sort of located the notion of ownership along a spectrum which has two ends to it. On one end, you have the notion of title, which is sort of a more abstract notion, that because I have some abstract claim, the deed, I own the deed, some sort of abstract theoretical claim on a particular object or entity, right? It could even be an abstract entity, or it could be a concrete one. Of course, in today's world, the objects, quote-unquote, that we own are increasingly complex, abstract, and very difficult to feel. They don't necessarily have physical texture in the way that often they did. But that would be one perspective on ownership. And then there's a much more sort of concrete and this-worldly perspective on ownership, which is much more about possession or control, sort of the notion that possession is 9/10 of the law. That doesn't mean that it's a complete lawless universe out there and that I can just grab anything that I want and just call it my own. But the notion that the very control or possession that I have is itself an essential dimension in the very essence of ownership. And so I have a very abstract kind of philosophical approach. We have a much more concrete approach. And these are very much competing, even in if you look at American law or common law and in many legal traditions where, of course, the question of ownership is a near universal question. How do you resolve these questions? It's not only halakha, it's the legal system that asks these kinds of questions. You'll find lots of different traditions and perspectives on this issue. It's a much more complex and layered issue than I'm obviously laying it out. But just for purposes almost as a heuristic, just to begin to think about it, those are different perspectives to lay the groundwork in terms of what ownership means. What we wanted to do in for our purposes is not to answer all those larger philosophical questions, but really to key in, to hone in on one insight or one critical question, which is, how does Judaism perhaps as a legal system differ from, let's say, a secular way of thinking about property ownership? In particular, given the notion that God is the creator, ultimately, of everything in this world, whether directly or indirectly, he has ultimate responsibility for all that exists. And we believe that not only is God responsible for the existence of all of that, but he maintains an ongoing active relationship with our world, whatever that means, and however you understand theodicy and all those naughty philosophical questions. But certainly, we are a theist religion rather than a deist. kind of approach, right? We believe that God has some sort of very meaningful, deep, ongoing interaction with us and with the universe, even if we can't always comprehend, even if we can't always pin down what exactly that means in every particular or given circumstance. Now the question is, does this complicate property ownership in the sense that not only am I competing with my friends, and not only do I have to worry about the inherent philosophical questions about ownership, not only do I have to define what is the nature of property ownership, and is it more about the abstract title, more about the actual possession, and what ramifications does that have, but now the fact that God has some sort of role as having created the world, does that somehow have an impact on or interfere with the notion of my own property? Do we say that in a sense, I don't actually have full ownership in the sense that perhaps I'm more a steward than a full-fledged owner? Now that's obviously not to say that halakha in any way denies ownership. That's obviously absurd. To any very basic look at even Chumash, never mind Torah Shebaal Peh, will immediately yield the conclusion that of course there's ownership, and there are entire sections of the Talmud that are rooted in the assumption that I can own something, and if you attempt to steal it from me, you don't have a right to do that. And so obviously we are not an anarchist kind of religion. Even some of the approaches to ownership, or at least the ideals of ownership that you find in the modern state of Israel in the earliest years, in the kibbutzim, and certainly the more radical among those early kibbutzim, certainly from a traditional halachic framework, that's not the frame of reference that we're thinking about, although you kind of wonder if there's sort of a kernel there of a Jewish truism there, but still, there's certainly clear, full-fledged, or meaningful ownership, and therefore laws that govern that ownership, how I come to acquire, how I come to lose my ownership, the rules that govern my rights, and what are, how far do they extend, what are the limitations of what it means to own something. There are concrete objects, there are abstract entities, there are partnerships, there are all sorts of, again, complex stock arrangements, and so on and so forth, shares that one owns in abstract entities that we call corporations that may or may not have real ownership, but what does that mean, and intellectual property, and all these kinds of conversations. But the notion of property certainly exists. But my question is more, do we somehow view it differently in light of that sort of divine imprint? Does that somehow interfere with my ownership here on earth? And we saw a few sources last time. We explored in greater depth than we'll do now the entire notion of reciting a bracha as predicated on the assumption, according to one line, major line of thought in the Gemara and other sources as well, it seems to indicate that is a form of ni'ilah, that to take an object without asking permission first from God is akin to stealing something from the temple, i.e. from God himself. It is from stealing from his own property rights, as it were. In other words, it's not just that God created it, but by virtue of his creation of this object, to some degree, Hashemayim Shemayim LaHashem V'Haaretz Natan L'Bnei Adam, yes, that's true, but only after I've recited my bracha. So at least prior to the recitation of the Gemara, of the bracha, the Gemara actually compares using or somehow deriving benefit from an object of this world, of God's creation, without that quote-unquote permission involved in the recitation of the bracha is in fact an act of theft. And so there's that sense, at least prior to the bracha, a very strong sense in which God has meaningful quote-unquote ownership over the object, albeit one that he automatically grants us once we've recognized that generosity. So that was one example. We gave a number of other examples that we started to explore. I was just reading at the end, the Rav extends this idea to talk about even the notion of children, how we think about quote-unquote ownership, it's a loaded term, of a child. In the ancient world, it was assumed that certainly one owned their child. In particular, the firstborn was considered to be a particularly critical relationship between a parent and the firstborn, a son in particular, in many ancient Near Eastern cultures, where it was understood that the parent had a certain kind of ownership or responsibility over the child, such that the child would ultimately then take on the torch of the family for himself, and then carry it on for future generations. And the Rav writes this very moving, intriguing letter to a priest of all people, who inquired as to the meaning of Pidyon HaBen. It's an undated letter, and the Rav essentially reviews the process, the ceremony of the redemption of the firstborn son, and explains that essentially what the Torah means to indicate is that the father, by giving these coins to the priest, to the Kohen, who's the stand-in, as it were, or God, is essentially making the symbolic statement that actually all that is not true. I don't own my child. If anything, my child is ultimately owned, quote unquote, by God. There's this higher purpose. Child is essentially, I have a stewardship over this child in my care. And so that's really fundamentally my relationship with my firstborn child. And I indicate that understanding by giving these coins in the symbolic gesture, which makes exactly that kind of statement. And there are many other examples of this, really interesting to think about. We even see this metaphor sometimes, either a child as a picadon, or different kinds of objects, sort of this notion that there is stewardship maybe over the environment. One could make a similar kind of suggestion. The Gemara says, Midrash, a classic Midrash in Kohelet Rabbah, where the Midrash says that, yes, I gave you Adam and Chava and humanity, the world, but you're meant to take proper care of it. Lo da'u l'shoma, you should continue to sustain it, and that's often cited in context of environmental discussions and where Judaism falls on those kinds of ethical discussions. And you can see how slowly but surely the notion of God's ownership, actually, even if not full-fledged, but the notion that really kind of really defines the sort of the parameters and the ways in which we relate to property in a way that someone without that religious bent really would not necessarily look at ownership from a purely secular lens. So that was sort of the first major point that we made, and we developed that in other contexts as well. So that was sort of the larger idea that we suggested. Now, what I wanted to do is to extend this, first of all, to an idea that I'm not even sure is 100% correct, but an intriguing possible corollary that I'm thinking about in light of this notion that that essentially God's, I want to just focus on this dimension for a moment. I'm going to start with source 9, as you said, it's on page 3. This notion that we said that what makes God the owner? Right, because we said, we asked the question, what is the basis for ownership? And we said that that's not an obvious question, but we do know that it would seem, on the basis of everything that we've seen, that Judaism postulates that God, who is the creator of the world, owns everything to some degree. Right? Obviously, God did not necessarily create this orange tree, right, which I'm now benefiting from, but in an ultimate sense, in the larger sense of the term, yes, God has the greater responsibility for the very existence of this tree, in the larger sense of the term, and therefore, by virtue of his having been the creator of this tree, again, in the ultimate sense of the term, God therefore, or thereby, comes to own the tree, which would seem to indicate that maybe there's a connection between creation and ownership, which is an interesting kind of idea. So here's the question, and I'm not the first to ask, how does that play out with regard to humanity?
Humanity.
In other words, if God comes to own objects, entities, due to his having been the creator of them, so when a human being, on a more immediate level, creates something, does he or she thereby acquire that which the individual has created?
So, for example, a painting. Right?
Yeah.
God creates the painting.
Mm-hmm.
He created it. Did God create the painting? Or did he create it?
Right.
So, does he own it?
A child.
Or then. And then, the painting is sold.
Right.
Why is the painting? So, you still own it because you created it?
Right. So the Gemara talks about this, we can set children for a moment, but it's a fair point, at least intellectually it is. And the Gemara talks about the notion that uman kone bishvach kli, that if I'm a craftsman and my profession is to take your object and to craft it on your behalf or to improve it, so even though it's true that originally you were the owner of the materials which were provided to me, by virtue of the fact that I created something new, that may allow me to now acquire it. Because I'm the creator, therefore, I have earned a certain kind of right. So this is going to be a question. Now, I just want to make the point that it's not just my invention, that there's this equation in halakha, I think, between creation and ownership. So if you take a look, you find this in two contexts, in Chumash, together with the commentaries as well. So in Source 9, Bereshit Perek Yudalad Pasuk Yudtet, this is the encounter between Malkit Tzedek, Melech Shalem, and Avram, after Avram had defeated the four king, the five kings, right, on the side of the four kings, and had saved his nephew Lot. So in that context, Malki Tzedek gives Avram a bracha, vayivarechehu vayomar, baruch Avram lekel elyon, some say el elyon, whatever it is, konei shamayim va'aretz. Now this is a very interesting term. Kone Shemayim Varetz is Malki Tzedek. What is Kone, or Kinyan? Right, is acquisition. But in context, and in fact, in the, at least the Sepharia translation that you have here, so it translates, and many translate, maker of heaven and earth. Isn't that interesting? And it wasn't just the translator here who suggested this, it's actually Rashi. Rashi comments in the Pasuk based on Chazal, Kone Shemayim Varetz, Kimo Osei Shemayim Varetz. Right? Like we read in Tehillim, Perek Kuf Lamed Aleph. Says Rashi, could not be more explicit. Al yidei asiyatan kina'an l'hiyot shela. By virtue of God having made them, having made Shemayim Ba'aretz, he acquired them to be his own. So we have this equation. Kone equals Bore. That the creator, the Bore, becomes automatically the Kone, and that seems to be the explanation for Avimelech, for Malki Tzedek, having substituted the term Kone Shemayim Ba'aretz for what we might have otherwise anticipated would be Bore Shemayim Ba'aretz. The fact that he interchanges them would seem to indicate that there is indeed an equation.
In both directions?
I think the Bore becomes a Kone.
Right. You can't go back.
It wouldn't work. If the question is, how do you come to acquire something? So you have to go in one direction. Right. That's what would emerge. Similarly, if you take a look at the pasuk in Ha'azinu, so Moshe Rabbeinu declares, Dvarim Periklam Ebe Pasuk Bav, Hala Hashem Tigluzo, Am Naval Velo Chacham, Hala Hu Avicha Kanecha, right? Behold, he is your father, your Koneh, again, your owner, it would seem, who ascha vayichonenecha, right? He was the one who made you and fashioned you or established you. And here it's not fully explicit as it is in Rashi, but it is implicit, I think, in the Pasuk. In other words, God is the one who created you, he fashioned you, and so as a result, he is the one who is konecha, the one who owns you. And so therefore, there's this critique, right? You foolish individuals, that you're rebelling against the Almighty who create, right? He's the one who created you to begin with. He quote-unquote owns you. You owe your very existence to him. What kind of nonsense is that, that then you would then turn your back on the one who brought you into existence and therefore, in a sense, owns you, right, in that way. So, again, I think a little bit less explicit, but I do think implicit in the Pasuk is, again, this equation between creation and ownership. And so, again, the question becomes, so once that's true, do we then say that once a human being begins to create something, then there's some sort of ownership that goes along with it, like this case of Uman Kone Beshvach Kli. Now, before we get to the next source that I have here, there's one more that I didn't actually put on the source sheet, but I wanted to share, which might take this idea and apply it to humans, but even extend it, possibly. And it runs as follows. So it also emerges from just sort of a careful look at some of the narratives in Bereishit. So we know that there's a basic distinction between the laws that govern Adam Harishon on the one hand, and Noach and his family upon their exit from the Teva on the other, with regard to their dietary laws. We know that the halakha was that originally Adam HaRishon was or was not permitted to eat meat, right? Not permitted to eat meat, and then all of a sudden Noach emerges from the Teva, right? And now all of a sudden humanity is permitted to eat meat. Rav Kook makes a big deal out of it and sees in this sort of a vision of vegetarianism for at least a distant messianic future. Some fascinating discussions about vegetarianism, Judaism's philosophy on that issue that emerge from this context. But that's not where I want to go for the purposes of this discussion. Where I want to go, what?
Because less on that, right?
We may have just touched on that one point, yeah. Yeah, I think last year. I think that's right. So let's, or if it was the Real Quick series, it was 2 years ago, but I don't know if you were here for that.
Yes.
Were you here for that? I'm trying to remember.
Okay. Yes, that's
incorporated last book. Yeah. So I did discuss it in that context. We should do it again, because it wasn't properly recorded. So I have to get them up online, but... And I'm a big fan of Ruben Cook anyway, so it's a good excuse to go back over it, but perhaps for another time. So this time, though, I want to share a different explanation. So there are two classical mefarshim in particular, Radak and Abarbanel, to a lesser degree as well, but in particular Radak, Rav David Kimchi, one of the medieval Spanish exegetes. So he tries to explain, again, why it is that there's this distinction. He doesn't see this, as some others do, as being essentially reflective of the ethical shortcomings or fall of humanity, right? That's essentially, right, that's an obvious alternative, where Adam Rishon was held to a very high ethical standard after the sins of humanity in the narrative of the Mabel. God came to the conclusion or decided to hold humanity ultimately to a lesser ethical standard, and therefore the rules were loosened, and Noah was permitted to eat meat as well, as one might have thought. Says the Radak, actually it's not what's happening at all, and this is not an ethical distinction whatsoever. Essentially what happened was that, remember, how did the animals survive the events of the flood? The Teva. Who built the Teva? Who brought the animals into the Teva? Who fed the animals in the Teva and ensured their survival?
Not Noah, right?
What? No, he says exactly that. It was exactly right. It was Noah himself. Right? He was on his own. So he essentially came to therefore own the animals. And therefore he was permitted to consume them. That's what he suggests. I never would have thought of this. It never would have occurred to me. The first one, the former, definitely this. Never in a million years. That's essentially what Radak suggests. It was really out-of-the-box kind of idea. It has certain kinds of logic and merit to it. So, when processing, and kind of thinking about this position of the Radak, I think it may be connected to what we're saying if we go a step further. In other words, okay, it's one thing to say, in God's case, or a person's case, I've created something, and therefore I own it. But once that's true, can we take that a step further and say, well, by the same token, I'm not the creator of this animal, but I ensured the survival of this entity, whatever it may be. So because I ensured that this object continued to exist, and if not for me, it absolutely would have been decimated beyond any shadow of a doubt, so thereby, in a sense, I'm not the immediate creator, but it's essentially the same thing. If not for me, it doesn't exist. And so therefore I am the master of this object, and therefore I have certain rights, which may, in the case of animals, include rights of edibility, right? Of a dietary nature. One wonders. So maybe that's what Radak has in mind, and sort of an extension of this idea. So now what's interesting to see is the possibility that this then makes its way into the halachic literature as well. Again, yet another extension, which I think is going even further and maybe debatable in terms of its application, but it's an interesting idea, and it's not my own, it's actually Rav Soloveitchik's suggestion. So I'll share that with you. So Rav Soloveitchik was commenting and analyzing Sugyan Bava Metzia and Daf Beit Amud Aleph, the Gemara in Source 12. So there the Gemara offers us the following, toward the bottom of that daf. The Gemara there is talking about the classic Mishnah of Shnayim Ochzin B'Talid. So you have two individuals who are both grabbing, let's say, equal amounts of the Talid. One says it's all mine, the other one says it's all mine, so what do we do with it? So Yachloku, we split it up, and so on and so forth. All sorts of complex, fascinating analytical issues that come up in terms of how do we view their respective rights to this object. It goes to the issue of title versus possession, the fact that you have a certain amount of possession. Does that give you inherently a leg up on the competition? Does that reflect the fact that maybe possession is indeed 9/10 of the law, and therefore that's why I have a larger claim, but if I'm holding 3/4 and you're holding 1/4, do we divide it accordingly? Does that change things? And so on and so forth. Fascinating discussions. And in that context, the Gemara says as follows, and I'm just taking the snippet that's relevant, it's part of larger sugya, but the Gemara says, Itani kula sheli. The Gemara says, had I taught at a certain point in the sugya that the entire object belonged, that the claim of one of the sides is that the entire talit belongs to me, hava amina, that I might have thought, ba'alma, as a general matter, to katani mitzatiha, that when a person says, I found it first, right, it's mine. So the Gemara says that I might have thought that bi'ri'iyah ba'alma kani. I might have thought, says the Gemara, that if we're out there and there's an object that's ownerless, that's lying outside, and one of us lays our eyes on that object and says, that one, that one's mine. I want it. That without touching the object, that without performing, normally we require a physical act of kinyan. So I'd have to go over to a movable object and I'd have to pick it up, hagbaha, or perform another kind of act of kinyan, an act of acquisition over the object. And Mar says, I might have had a havamina, that simply by looking at the object and saying, I want that thing over there, that somehow it belongs to me, and I get rights to that object prior to my friend. Gemara says, that's what I would have thought, and then the Gemara says that the sugya is coming to teach me that in fact that's not the case. You don't actually acquire it. Now there's a problem with this, because Tosfot in source 13, we won't read inside, but he notes that there's a Gemara elsewhere, in the Gemara, which sugya, which suggests essentially, in the Gemara in Bava Batra, that's a kuf yud chet aleph, which actually does suggest, in fact, that simply by laying my eyes on it, that I actually do acquire the object, what we call kinyan habata. This notion that simply by being mabit, but simply gazing at this object and saying, haha, right up there, like the light bulb goes off, and I decide I want it, that would be sufficient. Now this is a very strange idea. And again, our Gemara seems to reject. This Gemara later on seems to accept. Didn't Tosfot and the other Rishonim have extensive discussions? How do we account for this apparent contradiction between the sugyot? And maybe you have to lay eyes on it and do some sort of physical exertion to try to acquire the object, even though you didn't end up touching it or performing a traditional act of kinyan, and all sorts of different resolutions that are offered to this apparent contradiction. Now comes along the Rav, and the Rav sort of asks, this is strange, because the truth is that this is against everything that we ever learned about the halachot of kinyan. When it comes to kinyan, I have to take the object, pick it up, and do something physical with it if I want to come to own it. There are specific standards and criteria for, an act of ma'aseh kinyan, an act of acquisition, halacha. This notion that by staring at it and maybe doing a little bit of extra work according to Tosfot, I can come to acquire the object? What kind of halachic nonsense is this? This doesn't accord with anything that we ever learned in the world of kinyanin. So the Rav, now again, it's yet another step. I think it's a very big chiddush, but I think it's an intriguing one. Says the Rav, actually, perhaps it's this idea as well. Meaning, the Rav claims, and again, I think it's debatable, but the Rav's claim is that, essentially, if there's some object out there that no one has any relationship with, it's ownerless, it's just out there in the public domain, no one's engaging with it, no one's paying attention to it, no one wants it. So for all intensive human purposes, it's, as it were, out of our sphere. In other words, it doesn't relate to humanity. No one's engaging with it. No one's interested in it. No one's necessarily paying any heed to it. It's just irrelevant, certainly vis-a-vis ownership, to the world of mankind. So it comes along the Rav and suggests, well, if that's the case, so if I, quote-unquote, discover this object and take an interest in it, it's not just that I'm interested in it all of a sudden, but by gazing upon it and thinking, I want that object, in a sense, you've sort of introduced it, or reintroduced it, as the case may be, into the sphere of humanity, and in particular into the sphere of human domain and property rights and so on and so forth. So essentially what I've done is I haven't actually created anything, but I have brought this object, as it were, into the sphere of human interest and human acquisition. And therefore, in a sense, as it were, I have created, or at least discovered it. Again, I haven't created it, and I haven't ensured its survival, as in the case of the Mabul, but I've brought it into this world in a different sense. Again, not in a literal sense. And so therefore, says the Rav, if creation or discovery, right, or introducing it into the sphere of humanity is a form of creation, so then by extension, konesha mayim v'aretz, in that sense, perhaps I can come to acquire it as well. Now the Rav says perhaps we reject this as a matter of practical halacha, but the very thought, the very suggestion the Rav suggests goes back to this larger issue in terms of how we understand property ownership. So this is just an interesting, a little bit of an aside in a sense, but I think it's very interesting. In other words, if for Judaism one mode of acquisition is through creation, can we sort of imitate God, intriguingly, and come to acquire objects by creating them, ensuring their existence, introducing them into the public domain, and so on, and that would create the possibility of kinyan. Okay. So now I want to take a little bit of a turn. And again, there's so much to say about this topic. There are many sugyot that touch on this topic that we're not going to look at. But what I want to do with the remaining time this evening is to look at one subject that goes the other way around. In other words, not how I come to acquire something, but rather how I come to, as it were, lose my ownership over an object. Under what criteria do I no longer own something? I want to look at one small example and then one larger. The larger example is going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be about tzedakah. That's where we're going. But before we do that, I want to give you one small example that I skipped over intentionally back to source 8. So just take a look at that for a moment. And this is not directly about the question of the theological element and so on, but it does go a little bit to the question of the theoretical versus concrete theories of ownership for halakha. So I just want to point to one Gemara. There's a lot more to say, but just to point it out for our purposes. So Gemara appears in a number of places, including Bava Metzia, Daf Zayin Amud Aleph, which I gave you here, Gemara and Bava Kama, and Daf Samach Tet Mebet. Excuse me, I believe as well. And so the Gemara quotes a statement of Rabbi Yochanan. The Amar Rabbi Yochanan, did not Rabbi Yochanan say that Gazal, that if an individual stole something from someone else, Velo Niti Ashu HaBe'ale, and the original owners never gave up hope. Right? So I have, so it's a burglary, and I intend to recover my lost object, and I'm going to call the police, and I'm going to put up my signs, and the whole nine yards. So the halacha is that, right, so who's the rightful owner of this object? Clearly. Right, you stole it from me, so obviously I am. Right, so here's the question. Normally, if I own something, a concrete object, I have the ability to sanctify it to Shema. Right? So the Gemara says, if someone stole an object from me, and I intend to recover it, so therefore I remain the rightful ownership, I have every intention of recovering this object, the halacha is that nonetheless, neither of us has the ability to be makdish this object to Shemayim, to dedicate it, right, to God. Right? So the Gemara says, neither of us has that capacity. Why? So the Gemara explains, Shnehem inyam yichalim hakdisho. Neither one is capable of sanctifying this particular cheftza, this object. Zelefi sheina shelo. This, in other words, this one, namely the thief, obviously not, because it doesn't belong to that individual. It's not his. Vizeh lefi sheina birshuto. And this one, i.e. me, the rightful owner of this object who plans to get it back tomorrow, as soon as the police station opens again, right? And they're going to, I know exactly where it is. I'm going straight after him. Right? That crook, that good for nothing, doesn't matter. Since I no longer have control over this object, I cannot sanctify it. And by the way, there's a fascinating debate among the Rishonim, but probably the majority of you, I think the Rashba maintains this way and others as well, that similarly, I could not change ownership. In other words, let's say, right, you have it, and I decide, you know what, I really want to give it to, to gift it to Reuben, right? Maybe I want to give him like a fake, you know, I want to give him a fake gift or whatever. I'm kind of toying with him a little bit, whatever it may be. But let's say it's a serious gift. So the Rashba says, similarly, just like I can't sanctify it, I can't give it away. And if that's the case, if you can't sanctify it, and certainly if you similarly, you're not able to give it away to someone, so what does this Gemara seem to indicate? The Gemara seems to indicate to us that what? That ownership, right, is not just about title, but to some degree, it would seem that my ability to control the destiny of my object is contingent upon my control as well. And so this becomes a fascinating sugya. In other words, maybe halakha is taking both theories into account and saying that property is a complex amalgamation of these different aspects. That on the one hand, yes, obviously there's a title and you can't just steal my object, but at the same time it's also true that possession and control, right? It's not a question of right or wrong, right? By all, as an ethical matter, right? The guy has no right. He's just a scumbag who stole my object. It's mine. Nonetheless, I don't have domain. I don't have control over my property or that property right now that limits my capacity to make certain decisions with that object. So
once
just,
you got it back tomorrow, you can do that.
Absolutely, 100%.
So it's temporary.
Well, so long as I have control, it's whatever, for however long. So long as I have control, I can do so. So long as I don't, I cannot. that's right. But you're right. In other words, title is much more, because of its formality, is much more difficult to shift. Control is a much more free-flowing kind of characteristic, and so that would depend. So I just think it's a really fascinating kind of meditation source that sort of raises the possibility that, in fact, possession plays a major role in halakha alongside of the title pieces. Okay. Now to tzedakah. So we certainly can't do the entire topic of tzedakah in 15 minutes, nor is that our intention, but I want to go to a particular place. And the suggestion that I want to offer will require some introduction, but you'll see ultimately, I think, why this might reflect very profoundly on the notion of ownership, or the obligation of tzedakah. And so we'll start with, we're not going to read the entire passage, but you have here the passage from Parsha Re'eh in Source 14, Dvarim Perek Ted Vav, that when there is a one of your brethren who is impoverished, Ke'ev Echad Yom Yachad Achecha B'Yachad Shorecha, in your lands, so the Torah commands us. You're not permitted to harden, to tighten your fist, right? And to close your hands. Rather, there's a positive obligation to open your hands, Kipa Tachtiv Tachet Yad Chalo, right? One should actually, ideally, one should not just give the money that's necessary for the family to support themselves, but actually, in a theoretical world at least, in an ideal world, to even restore them to the same level of dignity that they had before this turn for the worse. And the idea of di machzoro, that if I can bring someone back to this, a similar lifestyle to what they enjoyed previously, that at least in theory, that's an ideal of tzedakah. In other words, it's not just to give them food for the table, but it's to give a sense of dignity and humanity, which might be relative, which might be subjective to the previously lived lifestyle of this particular family, and so on and so forth. And then the Torah says, Naton titein lo, the second to last pasuk here, in pasuk yod, you shall surely give to him, v'lo yirah levavcha b'tzitz chalo, and your heart should not be, quote-unquote, evil when you give to him, ki b'glah ha-davar is that, because for this matter, for giving the tzedakah, or as we'll see, for giving the tzedakah generously, but let's just say for now, for giving the tzedakah, yivarechecha Hashem elokecha b'chol ma'asecha u'v'chol mishlach yodecha, that God will bless you, and so on. Okay. Why is this so interesting? It's interesting in context of the sugya in Bava Batra. The Gemara in Bava Batra I didn't give you here, but we'll summarize outside. And the Gemara in Bava Batra tells a story in which there were some Amorayim who coerced Rav Natan to give tzedakah. Coerced him to give tzedakah in a particular context in their community, whatever it may have been. Okay? Very nice. So they required him to perform the mitzvah of tzedakah, and even when he didn't want to, they presumably went into his property and they required, and they said, you have no choice. The Beit Din went and they said, look, we need this as a communal need, you're required to give. Okay. So that all sounds very nice, and that's what the Gemara says, but there's a problem. And the problem is that we have a principle in Gemara elsewhere, in Gemara Masechet Chulin, where the Gemara teaches us that any time, well, the reason is it's an unusual principle, but let's just take it for granted for our purposes. Any time that the reward for a mitzvah is written alongside the mitzvah itself, right? So the Torah says, you should honor your parents, because by honoring your parents, you're going to enjoy a long life. Right? And so on. Right? Or you should send away the mother bird, as another example. Right? That's going to ensure longevity as well. Or, in the case of tzedakah, right? You should, because you give the tzedakah, God will bless you in everything that you do, and so on and so forth. So Tosfot and the other Rishonim come along and they say, what gives? The principle, we know that two things are true. Number one, anytime the Torah guarantees a reward in a particular context, that Beit Din don't coerce this particular mitzvah. Number one. For whatever reason, that's the principle of the Gemara and the Chulin. Number two, we know that the reward for giving tzedakah is written alongside the mitzvah tzedakah we just read in the Pesukim in Parsha Re'eh. So therefore, ask the Gemara, what gives? What's going on over here? Excuse me, ask those. So, and the other Rishonim, what's going on? How can it be that they coerce Rav Natan to give tzedakah if, after all, tzedakah, the mitzvah is written alongside the reward, rather, is written alongside the mitzvah, what we call matan schara b'tzida, that the giving of the reward, the matan schara, is written next to the mitzvah, and we know that in such a case, it's not permissible to coerce. That's against this principle in the Gemara. So that's the question. Tosfot and many others. And there are a whole host of answers that are offered by Tosfot and others. So I'll give you some examples. So one answer that's offered is by a number of the Achronim, including the author of the Ketzot HaChoshen. Ksod HaChoshen is one of the classic works among the Latter-day authorities, the Achronim. And the Ksod HaChoshen comes along in one of his commentaries and he says, you know what? It's a very simple matter. The Psukim are not here offering a reward for giving tzedakah. What's the reward for, if you read the Psukim carefully? The reward here was what? You shouldn't give in a miserly fashion. In other words, someone comes to me and I say, you know what, really I don't want to give you a cent. Really, right, I'm not interested in your plight, I could care less about you, but knew I'll throw money at you anyway. Right, so you shouldn't be miserly or stingy in terms of our attitude toward the mitzvah. So really, this is not a mitzvah with the reward fully written next to it. Really, the mitzvah of tzedakah you have to do independently. There's this additional point that you shouldn't have a bad attitude. But the basic mitzvah does not have the reward written next to it. So that's one answer that's offered. And then there are a whole host of other explanations. Tosfot here, in source number 15, we're not going to read the whole thing inside, but Tosfot actually offers right here already no less than four answers to this question, aside from the one that we mentioned. So he's got a whole range of explanations. So he says, well, maybe there's a distinction between force and coercion by force and coercion by that is verbal in nature. So he says, when the Gemara says that they forced Rav Natan to give tzedakah, it didn't mean they physically coerced him. That you're not allowed to do, that's true. But they basically urged him, right? They protested outside of his house, and they embarrassed him enough, right? So like they're just like these good for nothing guys who give a get. So they convinced Rav Natan to give a tzedakah for this really big laugh. Okay, right. So maybe that's the explanation. That's the position of Rabbi Nutan. That's his explanation. There's another explanation that says no. It's true that we don't force for a positive command that the mitzvah is written next to it. But with regard to tzedakah, let's remember it's not just a positive commandment. It's a negative as well. Remember, the Torah says you have to open up your hand, but it also says lo tikbot at yarchav. Right? You can't be stingy. You can't close your hands. So it's true. If it's just a positive commandment, that's one thing, and they wouldn't have been able to coerce. The reason they were able to coerce here is because what? Because there's a negative commandment. Tzedakah has multiple mitzvot. There's a mitzvah to say, but there's also alongside him lo taseh. For the mitzvah to say, they would not have been able to coerce. But for the negative commandment, for the mitzvah lo taseh lo tikbot at yarchav, right? Lo tamid levachav lo tikbot at yarchav. So for that, they were able to coerce, and that's the second excerpt of Tosfot, and so on and so forth. He's got another suggestion. He suggests that really Beit Din is allowed to coerce, just that they're not punished if they don't coerce. It's a third answer. And then there's a fourth suggestion as well that says, yeah, but if the community agrees to it, that's different. In other words, if there's a communal arrangement where it's understood that everyone in the community agrees to a certain kind of tax or a certain kind of community responsibility, so that already is a different kind of thing, which is actually pretty interesting in its own right. Okay, so Tosfos has all these answers that he suggests, but that's not what we're here for. What to me is the most interesting answer in many respects is the answer if you jump to page 7 and then page 8, the answer of the Ritva. The Ritva, one of the Spanish medieval commentaries, the classic Mefarshim on the Gemara, Rabbeinu Yom Tov Ashbel. So the Ritva comments on this in two contexts, one in Rosh Hashanah and one in Gemara and Ketubo. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'll share with you essentially what he says outside. And the truth is that in the two contexts where he addresses the issue, it's a little bit different. We can see the language actually here, just the language in the bold at the bottom of source 18. And in each one, it's a little bit different. To me, the most interesting one for our purposes is source is the next one, the one on page 8. But let's read both of them. So the first answer, he asks these questions and he gives some answers. And he suggests, in the bold, V'lo gamrina mina la'alma. He says, what about this problem that you can't coerce, right? So why is our case different? He says, you can't learn from tzedakah to other contexts. Why? Mishum dehacha, la'av mishum mitzvah deramia alei bilchud kaifinan. He says, there are two dimensions here with regard to tzedakah. Yes, it's true that I have to give. But he says, there's another point here, which is that it's not just that I have to give, but that because I've made a commitment, the poor person has a right to receive the money. In other words, normally, when we're talking about coercing someone, or forcing someone to perform a mitzvah, It's not because they have to give someone something, right? Baked in, this guy, good for nothing. We wouldn't do this nowadays, but in theory, on some level, guy won't take the lulav, so baked in is going to force the person to perform that mitzvah, right? And so on and so forth. So that's just fulfillment of the mitzvah, and that's it. It's not like they owe the lulav to anyone, or the arvamina have to give them. No. There's a mitzvah of arvamina, l'kachtem lachem b'yom rishon. Person, for whatever reason, not fulfilling the mitzvah, so Beit Din has the responsibility to ensure that the individual properly performs the mitzvah. It says, tzedakah, though.
You own that one, though?
What?
You own it?
But you go like this, okay? Whatever. But just again, we don't implement it nowadays, but yeah, right, you're saying you could renounce ownership and I hear you. Okay, so you figure out the other mitzvah, whatever it may be. So the Ritva says, had this been comparable to the mitzvah of Aminim or any other mitzvah that was just about me and God, that would have been different. But here, there's another dimension of the mitzvah. It's not about the mitzvah. It's not so much that Beit Din is forcing Rav Natan to give the tzedakah because Rav Natan has an obligation incumbent upon him as a ben mitzvah, bar mitzvah, to give tzedakah. Had that been the reason, we would not have coerced him. There's another dimension as well. The ani, the poor person in this community, as it were, has some sort of monetary rights to that which I own. Right? Has some sort of right to this. There's like a shiba. It's like a chov. It's almost as if I owe you $100. Right? You have a shibud against me. A financial responsibility on the basis of some prior financial arrangement between the two of us. I owe you $100. I owe you $1,000. So that can be in context of a business deal that we've made between ourselves, or it could be built into the very structure of ownership in a communal context in which there are people who have a halachic right to this money. And among those individuals, even though I've never made a commitment necessarily, are the aniyim in my community. And it's particularly striking in the next source, in the Ritva, source 19, he says, yeah, that's kind of the idea. He says, toward the end, he says, Gali Rachmana, 5 lines from the bottom of source 19, this is the one in Masechet Tuvot, on Mem Tedem Abed, he says, Gali Rachmana b'tzedaka shotzi b'fiv, says that's true if I make a commitment, v'hu adin l'chol tzedaka, even if I did not make an oral commitment to give tzedaka, by virtue of the halachic obligation to give tzedaka, the ani has a right to it. There's a shibud nechasim for the poor person, mishum machsoram shel aniyah. And a number of other commentaries explained within the Rambam and others, there's a Kesef Mishnah, there's a Radvaz, and many others we don't have the time to read through right now, who all suggest this idea. They say, and there's this debate about this, the Rashba disagrees, but there are many commentaries who hold on this basis, that yeah, it's possible to argue that the ani has a shibud in my nechasim, that my property actually is a lien on my property from the poor people in my community, even if I never made any commitment whatsoever, that there's this inherent right that they have to my money. And it's been suggested along these lines, and it's a remarkably far-reaching idea, that this might be rooted in not just the rights of the poor in my property, but that there seems to be something much deeper here. Whereas what's being suggested, I think, is that according to the Ritva, in that school of thought, essentially, it's a question fundamentally of how we view my property. See, until now, I thought that I have my property, I owned it fair, right? I came to acquire it fair and square, it belongs to me, and not to anybody else. And that's true to some degree. But what the Ritva suggests is that the notion of the aniyim, at least in the community, there's some sort of inherent right, and that's almost a limitation that's built into my ownership. When God gives me the money, it's again, it's sort of stewardship, or there's at least some degree to which the aniyim in my local community have some sort of right. Now, again, that doesn't mean that it's not, and so on and so forth, but it means that this sort of a notion that there's a gifting, and that there are a sort of a larger theological context to the notion of ownership, which I think is really interesting. I just wanted to add for our purposes that there's an interesting analog to this during the Shemitah year in particular, where there's a classic debate, at least the way it's generally understood, between the various Latter-day commentaries, the Mabit of Yosef of Trani, and Beit Yosef, actually, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, and his responsa of Kat Rochel, sources 21 and 22. We know that the law is that during the Shemitah year, that I need to declare my property ownerless. and to allow the poor people to come. This is an interesting question. Let's say I don't do that. Let's say I neglect the obligation to declare my property ownerless. What's the halacha? So there seems to be, at least the general said, there's a classic debate as to whether the Torah says, okay, you didn't observe this halacha, therefore it's not ownerless, or, again, it's kind of built into the system of Shemitah, that it's true that you chose not to follow the law, but no matter. Woven into the very notion of property ownership during the Shemitah year is that if you own a field, it's ownerless. It's built into the system. It's inherent to my ownership. So again, a very similar idea that approximates the idea of the Ritva. So for me, what's interesting is that tzedakah, but just as an example, or Shemitah, or I think the other examples that we gave earlier as well about brachot or the child, all these, I think there's just sort of a very interesting question, which is that what we see here is that Judaism's theology really has profound ramifications in terms of how we view ownership, which again does not mean that there isn't a notion of ownership. It's very clear that there is, and a very strong notion of ownership in Judaism, and yet nonetheless, the theological context, I think, frames the way that we think about our money, and I think it offers us, I think, a lot of food for thought. So that's sort of what I wanted to share. There's much more to say about this topic. It's a sprawling topic across many, many, many topics, and we're barely scraping the surface, but given that we're going to the break, I thought it would be good to leave it here. And then, God willing, next time we'll pick up. I'll let everyone know, but we're going to change topics for next time. But I wanted to leave it here. Because we're off next week, I wanted to wish everyone a Chag Kasher V'Sameach. We'll be around the majority of Chag. We'll be away the first days, then we'll be back. So anyone know where everyone's plans are, but whatever it is, we hope you enjoy your Chagim here, there, wherever. Let's see everyone's there. Good. Thank you. Shkach.